Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
Francisco Goldman is a writer and a scholar and a man who contains paradoxes. And his work also contains paradoxes in which tenderness and torture live side by side, in which sweetness and humiliation share a dwelling place in the mind. And a while back, in May of 2021, I had the kind of conversation with Francisco Goldman that I really like. It was about his book, Monkey Boy, but it was about a whole bunch of other things, too, because he's the kind of person you have that kind of conversation with, a conversation about art and life and everything else. So, Monkey Boy is out in paperback now, so why not have that conversation all over again? Or at least play that conversation all over again. Get ready to meet somebody who operates on a lot of different levels. And we are going to talk to him about that thinly disguised piece of fiction that's called Monkey Boy. And a lot of other things.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
So when we're in transit, on a train from New York to Boston, on a plane from Hartford to Dublin, we're really nowhere, in none of those places. And the mind takes the opportunity to wander through the gardens and the ash heaps of our pasts. This, we're told, actually can even happen while walking around Dublin of a day. We re-examine choices and journey through multiverses where our loves and lives are constituted differently. We dwell more on pain and embarrassment than on pleasure and triumph. In the novel Monkey Boy, our narrator takes us on one of those mental odysseys, while indeed on a train from New York to Boston. And his mind takes a serpentine trip through the past in which the torture of high school humiliation leans against memories of actual tortured bodies in a morgue in Guatemala. And it's those kinds of tensions and paradoxes that really characterize the work of our guest today, Francisco Goldman, a writer and journalist. He has published 5 novels, including Say Her Name and 2 books of nonfiction. The Art of Political Murder, Who Killed the Bishop, is now an HBO documentary, which I recommend. And his new novel, which I also recommend, is Monkey Boy. Who cares whether I recommend it? Why am I saying this? He teaches creative writing and literature at Trinity College, 1 semester a year. And he's joining us right now. Francisco Goldman, how are you?
Good. Thanks, Colin, for that great intro. And I'm doing well.
Where are you? I know you've been in Mexico City a bit lately, right?
Well, we live in Mexico City.
Yeah.
And usually I come up for 1 semester a year, like you said, to teach in Hartford at Trinity.
So for people who are curious, give people your thumbnail of Monkey Boy. We're going to meet Francisco Goldberg, who seems like it might be kind of, you know, a very close doppelganger of yours. Tell us about this particular Francisco.
Well, you know, it's the changing that man to a bird right away is like taking a first step into the moving machine of fiction, right? Just that little step freed me from any obligation to be accurate and faithful to the actual facts of my life the way I would be if I were writing an autobiography, and gave me the freedom to, you know, to invent in the way of fiction, to look for things, to think through story, you know, in the way you can only do in fiction. And so it's, in some ways, I'm obviously using things from my life as I'm writing this novel, but I'm also leaving out a lot. And it was a way to just tell a story with, and think about things that were really mattered to me a lot at the time I was writing these, you know, the novel. Among those things, my mother was in a nursing home. She died in the middle of the writing of this book. And I think that she's at the center of the book. My relationship to her contrasted with my relationship with my father. And I think another big theme of the book is, Say Her Name, you might know, is about, based on my relationship to Aura Estrada, my wife, who at the age of 30 died from broke her neck in the waves in Oaxaca in 2007. And that was an incredibly life-altering event for me. It took a long time for me to get out of the grief of that incident. But I was also wanted to think about in this book, well, first of all, why did it take me so long to find love in my life? Examine the things in my past, you know, that had made me inhibited me in some ways. And to try to, like, so she's not in the book. So I'm basically also, and this really makes it a novel, I'm kind of asking myself, what might my life have been like if I'd never met Aura? How much longer might it have taken me to find love in my life, right? So I met Aura when I was 47. In this book, he's 49, right? On this trip home to Boston.
Yeah, in the promo for today's show, I think I called it something like a Guatemalan Jewish Catholic American 8.5. it has a little bit of that 8.5 quality, I think, and particularly because, you know, this is very much a book about women. I mean, you mentioned your mother, and by the way, condolences on her passing. But this is a book about the women of your life, your mother, your sister, many of these very sort of strong female presences from your life in Guatemala. I assume you're very conscious of that you're writing way more powerfully, I think, about the women of your life here.
Yeah, you know, another friend, Aura's very best friend, Nati Paris, she read the book and she said, this is like, this is your Todo Sobre Mi Madre, the Almodovar movie all about my mother. So it's interesting that two movies in which male directors focused on their relationships to women, have been compared to this book. And I think that's very true. I knew I wanted to look at, as I said, my relationship to women. I know from the start, my sister, thinks of our family as like we were three survivors of a very brutal household, right? And in many ways, a very brutal town. I think one of the things, like I said before, that I really wanted to try to understand in this book was why I was sort of unable to love the woman I loved throughout, you know, my early life. As you said, my grandmother, my Guatemalan grandmother, was a very strong figure in my life as I was growing up, and also very dominant and very decisive in some of the choices my mother made with her own life, because my grandmother was very strict. She was a wonderful woman, but she was a very, very strict Catholic. And so, a really decisive moment in my mother's life was when she fled back to Guatemala with me as a boy, really fleeing the abuse, my father's abuse. We might have stayed there. I would have grown up in Guatemala, but I got tuberculosis after a couple of years of being down there. And I think my grandmother saw my getting tuberculosis as sort of divine punishment for my mother having left my father. And we went back, and my mother just should have, you know, it's pretty obvious when you read the book that you say this poor woman, if only she could have divorced. Mm-hmm. But because of that heavy Catholic, you know, divorce was out of the question. And so my mother decided to make a life for herself, right? She wasn't just going to be trapped in the house all day. And she decided she wanted to go to college. And so my grandmother used to send up these wonderful young women, the first one who came right out of an orphanage when she was like 15 years old. It was a different time, you know, back then. She came up and she was, would do housework and was like my second mother and was incredibly close to me. Well, my mother began to go to college, and eventually my mother made herself into a college Spanish teacher. But I, throughout the rest of my life, to this day, I'm very close to that woman who helped raise me. And you meet her in the book, and you meet some of the, it was a series of girls. My grandmother basically founded a colony of young Central American women in the Boston suburbs that is now in its third generation, right? Some of them already having become grandmothers. Because the funny thing is they all come up to Boston to help take care of me and my sister. And eventually they all leave because they all get married. So, I think some of them stay for several years. One girl arrives and it's very mysterious. She arrives and 2 weeks later she leaves to get married. And I never understood how that could have happened. And you meet, some of the, one of the things he's doing on this trip home to Boston is he's not just going to see his mother, but Francisco Goldberg is kind of a semi-well-known writer, and he's been on the radio, and the girl he had a big unrequited love for when he was in the 10th grade and was probably his only important adolescent female relationship has heard him on the radio and has contacted him. So this is his first night in Boston. Of course, he's going to have dinner with her. So it's a novel about my relationships with women. And I think that mirrors my own life, without a doubt, in the United States. It's a funny thing, because I think here in Mexico and in Central America, I have some very good female friends, but most of my close friends are probably male. And in the United States, it's the opposite. I think the majority of my really close friendships in the U.S. are with women, including now that we have a daughter. It's funny, we have a daughter now. I finally fell in love and remarried. Azalea is 3 years old now. And she has a squad of six godmothers. And three of those godmothers are exes of mine who I stayed close to, through the years. So, from the United States. So, I wanted to look at those relationships from my past, which, as you said, are with really, I think, very strong, sometimes eccentric, fascinating women. I never understand why some people are so surprised. That you often hear people saying, that men especially can't write about women, or it's difficult for men to write about women. I don't find that at all. Partly because I grew up in a household, where I was a woman, basically. And my whole life I've been very close to them. So I don't find it inhibiting at all to try to write about women, honestly.
Yeah, I always wondered about how fussed up people get about that, too. I think there are other dichotomies and disparities that are much harder to bridge imaginatively. I think it's harder for someone who's been basically well off all of his or her life to imagine what it's like to be poor than it probably is for a man to imagine what it's like to be a woman of a kind of similar social status. But yeah, actually, rather than go down that alley right now, though, one thing I wanted to talk about here, and just tell me if I'm getting this right, because I might not be. But it seems to me that Goldberg, in his reveries, in his thoughts, in his visits to various parts of the past, there's a way in which, pain is pain, and pain, emotional pain, and psychic pain can be caused by really extreme situations. He and you have been in situations in Guatemala in which the danger was very, very real. In fact, he, and I assume you have at the point, left Mexico City, partly because there's been an intercepted communication that indicates that, maybe he's in danger right now and he needs needs to get out of that part of the world and be someplace right. else, you know? And so there's that. And there's this visit to the morgue where he sees tortured bodies. And there's these things that, you know, I've never experienced. I would find just so existentially terrifying that I feel as though they would just trump everything and blot everything out. But I feel reading this as though some of the really, really visceral humiliations of high school, where this named Monkey Boy and you make out with a girl, and then there's this thing where supposedly she might have compared you to a monkey eating a banana while you guys are making that's just horrible in its own way, you know, that pain is pain. Say a little bit more about that.
That's exactly, you know, I think that it's really great that you use the word, those experiences in Central America trump, you know, the trivial humiliations of daily life, because that's exactly what I was trying to use that idea to frame the novel. I was sort of rebelling against the hierarchies I myself impose on my own life, have in the past, and that other people impose. So you've been down, you know, as I spent, you know, many, many years, all of my 20s in Central America, trying to write my first novel, but very close, and also working supporting myself as a freelance journalist, very close to that incredibly violent human tragedy that was occurring. And I've continued to live close to those things throughout my working life. And I think sometimes, you know, as a writer, I'm constantly, of course, asking myself what I still owe to that experience, right? What can I still tell about it? Because those things form you, and you really feel you've witnessed such a combination of tragedy and suffering, but also generosity and bravery, that you feel that, you know, that's very important, and that makes other things in your life less important. And I wanted to, and I realized that there's so much that happened in my life that I wasn't allowing myself to really write about, because I myself was submitting to this hierarchy of what's really important and what's trivial. And I thought, well, what if, you know, if I go take a 5-day trip home, right, you know, to see my mother, to see some, you know, people I was close to. During those 5 days from New York to Boston, I'm not going to be thinking all the time about the wars in Central America. I'm going to be thinking about my mother. I'm going to be thinking about the girl I'm going to see. I'm going to be thinking about, my relationship with my father, about growing up in this town that I'm now going back to. And of course, I'm still going to be bringing those experiences, like the war in Central America with me. They're still a part of who I am. But you're not going to dominate the narrative of these 5 days. And that's really what so it was a way of freeing myself to write about those other things that really set me off, you know, set me down the road of writing Monkey Boy. And, you know, a big difference is you have a different person, you know, you look at those incredibly painful humiliations of your youth. And even, you know, the really brutal violence, in the relationship with my father. And because you have it in a different perspective, so many years have passed, you're who you are now. It's really important to understand in this book, like this is not about the solemnity of victimhood in any way. I'm not saying, oh, poor me. You know, I had to these things have to be told the way you experience them now, which is painful, but also with humor. You know, so many of these things were just so absurd. So I really had fun writing about some of those youthful humiliations. Like, yeah, you know, my first kiss, what a complete catastrophe. You know, supposedly the girl said she felt like a banana being chomped on by a monkey, and the whole school picked up that refrain, and I was being mocked for weeks, and it was horrible. It really did traumatize me.
And it was a kind of layered sense of betrayal, too, because you thought the words might not have come from her, but from a kind of quote-unquote friend of yours who might have put those words in her mouth.
Charismatic bully who really dominated a lot, not just a lot of my childhood youth, but, you know, he was a lot of other kids and are around me, right? He was one of those people that you know, you never forget, right? He probably never thinks about us, but here we are, you know, all these years later, remembering, you know, his reign of terror over middle school and high school. You know, that's really true.
You know, reading the book, I my mind flashed back a couple of times to a Neruda poem that I really love. It's called Let's Wait. And at the end of it, he says, artisans of the soul are building and weighing and preparing, days bitter or precious that will knock at your door in due time to award you an orange or murder you in cold blood where you stand. And I think, you know, there's a lot of that in your book. There's this kind of sliding doors sense that, you know, the door slid open one way and this one set of things happened. Had it slid open a different way, had you walked through a different aperture, a whole other different set of things happened. At the end of the book, you're really talking about this witness connected to this very famous assassination of a bishop in Guatemala. If I hadn't met the witness, my life would be different. If I'd been born in Guatemala, I would have been conscripted into the army. I'd probably be dead from the endless wars there. There's that, you know, I feel that there anyway, that you're sort of toying with those questions, right. the arbitrariness that Neruda describes at the end of that poem.
That's such a good perception, right? I mean, for me, the aesthetic model for this novel was we here have right near my house where I live, the famous architectural masterpiece of Luis Barragán, the Barragán house. And what I loved about that house is it looks like just a normal, functional, classical, modernist house. But as you move through it, every room is a surprise, right? And I wanted my book, you know, to feel that way. It's like going forward like a kind of normal novel, but you're constantly like being surprised by what comes up next. And I think that that was a way of like looking at sort of the arbitrariness of the way things unfold in life and combined with the decisions you make and how they affect you. And so, when I talk about like, you never stop feeling that you owe things to say your experience in Guatemala, right? For Francisco Goldberg, even to a greater degree than for Francisco Goldman, to be honest, but still to some degree, the art of political murder, you know, the crime that book is based on changes his life. And that crime, that book, and this is true, would not exist if it weren't for that witness, right? This homeless man who lived in the park, who was actually an ex-soldier who had been infiltrated by military intelligence to spy on the bishop, right? And was somehow pressed into taking part in the murder that night. And they were sure he would never speak, that he would, because if they could, you know, he would die if he ever spoke out. But he was an incredibly crafty, wily survivor and made his way, he had this longing for dignity and wanted to appease his own conscience. He did the bravest thing I'd ever seen, this, right? He had no power at all, but he began to collaborate with the prosecutors, and if he had not become a witness, that case would never have gone to trial, even. Never mind the military officers having been convicted. I never would have written that book, and my life would be quite different, right? And so, and now, during the time I was writing the book, interestingly enough, the prosecutors had lost track of the witness. They didn't know where he was. And they were asking me if I knew where he was, and I didn't know. So that's one reason in the book, you know, he kind of imagines that people thought it was possible that maybe he crossed over into the United States, like so many people fleeing for their lives in Central America and Mexico do. And so, so that's why he keeps popping up in the narrative of Monkey Boy, where Francisco Goldberg keeps imagining that he sees them in different places and is sort of thinking about what he means in his life. For The Art of Political Murder, for the documentary movie, we did, in fact, finally track him down. And that was remarkable, too.
Yeah, you know, the Art of Political Murder and this book, I think, raise a question that most of us don't really have to face at quite the same level, which is, how long do you hang in there? How long do you stay before you feel like you have to leave? I mean, in the Haradi case, you know, there's a prosecutor who obviously means to do well. And at a certain point, he just thinks, no, I got to get out of here with my family because it's just too dangerous. And then another prosecutor comes in and kind of really does wrap up the job. Similarly, there are magistrates. There's a series of judges, I think, who just can't hang in there. And then this incredibly brave woman kind of steps up. And that's there for you, it's there for everybody. You know, I mean, there's a woman named Ursula who gives you the tour of the morgue. And so many of the things are punctuated. Well, now she's in Canada, or now she's in California, or people who just sort of had to get out of there, or their families made them get out of there, or whatever. But it's a really interesting question, is how do you know when you have to leave? How do you avoid staying too long? You know, and it's one that you had to face. There are these descriptions in the book of this, you know, beer bottle and soda bottle alarm system that you and this woman, Penny Moore, have, which is the only way you're going to know if a death squad is coming into your apartment. And at that point, you've got a garden tool that you're going to try to fight them off with. I mean, it must be sort of in your mind all the time. Yes, somebody could be coming to the door with an orange or with a gun.
Yeah, in that particular house, I had a hilarious system rigged up. So if the bottles broke because somebody was coming through the window, that was our alarm system, bottles on chairs under the windows. If I heard a glass break, I knew to run to a certain window where I had tied a rope from which I would be able to like let myself down into the patio of the next door neighbor's house. And when I moved back to New York after that period, I went back to New York after that terrifying long period in Guatemala. And I remember I still had a subletter in the house that I went back to in New York. And so I was in the bedroom and he was sleeping in the living room, and he broke a glass. And I reflexively jumped out of bed and ran to where my window would have been in Guatemala City. Mm. And I ran face first into the wall. And, you know, it's how do you know when to get out? You know, it's in the case of that prosecutor, well, it's when they started to follow his children home from school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that will make anybody leave.
Yeah.
Right. The prosecutor who stayed, he was insanely brave.
Mm-hmm.
They were threatening him constantly. They set people up. They were walking on his roof at night. He hung in there till he got those convictions and then left the country with his family the very next day and mm-hmm. didn't come back for years. He's back now working as a prosecutor again. I think that a country like Guatemala and some of the other Central American countries and Mexico too, you know, if the way power works in those countries, they're designed to completely humiliate and break people who are decent and brave in those positions. And what happens is you get some of these judges and you get some of these prosecutors finally, and they say, you know, I didn't become a judge to be a coward and get down on my knees and let these evil people, you know, these corrupt people trample over me. You know, I became a prosecutor because I wanted to prosecute cases. And finally, something like that stiffens in them. It's a remarkable thing to see. It's not about political ideology, like sometimes people think. You know, so more often it's about, like, you are not going to break me. I'm going to do my job. I'm going to do what I always dreamed of doing, whatever it costs. And that's very rare. Mm. It's so rare that victories against that kind of evil in the legal system in those countries are incredibly rare. But now and then, as happened in the Harari case, you have enough people together, right? Mm-hmm. Prosecutors, judges, investigators, that band together and all do it at once and are lucky enough to get some international support, because that's important too. And it happens. And that's what made the Art of Political Murder, that story tells the story of a really remarkable accomplishment and a rare one.
It really does.
I haven't seen anything like that in Mexico.
All right, we're going to have to take a little break here, and we're going to come back with lots more. Francisco Goldman, his new novel is Monkey Boy. We'll be back after this. There's something here I find hard to ignore. There's something that I've never seen before. I'm a flowers
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In-Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries.
We are back. I am talking with Francisco Goldman, a writer, journalist. He has published 5 novels, 2 books of nonfiction. The Art of Political Murder, Who Killed the Bishop, is now an HBO documentary in which he appears. It's based on his book. His novel is Monkey Boy. He teaches creative writing and literature at Trinity, one semester a year, Trinity College in Hartford, that is. So I wanted to ask you a little bit. I mean, first of all, we should say Monkey Boy straddles geographically different worlds as well, and including quite a bit set in Boston. And you still, you know, live an American life at times and teach at Trinity and stuff like that. I'm just sort of wondering how can I even phrase this? So there's this phrase that I kind of developed during the Trump era, which was the narcissism of the present moment, which is the tendency of people, particularly I think Americans, to think if they're thinking that something's really bad, if they're thinking the Trump era is really bad, they think it's the worst period in history. And they'll say that this is the worst thing that's ever happened. And I found myself saying, well, I don't know. Geez, I lived through like 69, 70, 71 in America. That was pretty bad. I mean, we haven't had like a Kent State thing or weather underground bombings and stuff. I'm not sure this is even the worst moment of my lifetime. But it must be weird and jarring if you have lived through, say, the 80s in Guatemala, and then you see people reacting. I don't know. Maybe it has 2 different ways of exciting you. On the one hand, maybe you, I don't know if you, if it all looked to you like, oh yeah, no, I know what this looks like, and I know what it could lead to, and you're right to worry. But it did. Maybe you felt that way. But did you also feel like, yeah, this is bad, but boy, you guys haven't seen bad. You don't know what bad looks like.
Oh, that's a hard one, yeah. Right? Because they're, I mean, you know, the United States and Central America, they're such different circumstances. Honestly, what happened in Guatemala in the 80s, you know, the UN called it a genocide, mm-hmm. Right? It doesn't get worse than that, right? Hundreds, you know, 200,000 civilians, essentially.
Young people.
Young people, especially young people, you know, a woman slaughtered, right? By a U.S.-backed military. And it didn't have to happen, right? It was completely so wasteful and so cruel. And what did it lead to? I mean, those countries right now are in extraordinary crisis because it didn't lead to democracy. It led to essentially narco states, right? These mm-hmm. countries that are completely run by, and what you saw in the last years was just how important it is for the U.S. to try to have some, you know, after the Cold War, there's no such thing as being a hypocrite in history. You know, you react to the moment, and just because the U.S. did bad things in the 80s doesn't mean they can't do good things, you know, after, you know, in the 90s and 2000, right? It doesn't, one doesn't cancel out the other. And so it's a long story, but the U.S. came down the sides from George W. Bush through Obama. The U.S. really tried to help strengthen justice institutions in places like Guatemala and Central America. It was still very difficult. You could say, you know, it managed to hold off the complete descent into narco state corruption. Trump undid that, right? Mm-hmm. Trump actively abetted that end of the rule of law in those countries. Partly because he wanted things from Central America. He wanted them to collaborate with him on immigration and things like that. And those were very corrupt rulers. And so in return, they essentially were allowed to consolidate the hold of organized crime on those states. And now it's probably maybe too late. Right now what's going on there is so horrible. So you think all that war, you know, all those people dead, and this is what it led to, right? Not democracy, but completely criminal regimes, partly because at a very critical time, the United States made itself absent, which is strange to think because so many of us, you know, don't, you know, sometimes think, well, the U.S., it's better the U.S. not get involved. Well, that's not really true, right? And so, you know, what was Trump, right? I mean, was Trump the worst I've seen? I think morally he was the worst I've seen. And I was just even thinking this morning because I was reading in the New York Times about the huge, massive rise of anti-Semitism in the U.S. And you remember Charlottesville and, you know, those people chanting Jews will not replace us. And you think what's happening with Asian Americans and all the attacks on Asians. And of course, you know, the Black, the killings by policemen, of unarmed, often usually unarmed Black people. And it just really is dismaying. I mean, I have to say, the state of the United States right now, with just so much unleashed hatred, it alarms me. I've never seen a period like this. I know the 60s were violent in a different way. Mm-hmm. I just think that something is, I think that something got broke in the United States. And we see it in this kind of really unprecedentedly polarized political system. I think it's true that something has ended, right? Mm-hmm. Something that has ended. Some people say that neoliberal, basis of American politics or something. And we're teetering between a future that's still not quite defined and whether that will be more populist or whether that will be autocratic and, you know, extremely right wing. That seems to be in what used to be called the center seems to have eroded tremendously. I don't know if that's how things are going to play out, but that's kind of how it looks now. And I think it is kind of alarming, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know how, you know, I mean, I can theorize. I'm sure, you know, we could all sit around and think about how we could improve it. I think it's just time. I think young people, I teach at Trinity, as you know. Mm-hmm. And so when you sit there, you have a bird's eye seat to what's going on with young people, right? And how they change over the years. And I've been stunned by just how wonderful so many of these young kids are. Right? Mm-hmm. I've really seen a change. And over the last, I don't know, it's the last 5 years or something like that, where the kids just seem so tolerant of each other and the good, you know, not everybody, there's exceptions, right? But just as a whole, right, they really seem to have, have developed in a way that makes you hopeful for the country. No, they know what's at stake. They're politically alert. They're politically smart. They're not fanatics. They seem to want solutions to problems. They think big. You know, like how are we going to handle climate change? You know, yeah. So they give me a feeling of optimism. And yes, you know, and I hope my daughter, right, will. Obviously, it means so much to me that things evolve, you know, improve, and that we see younger people start moving our societies in a better direction. I think my generation, perhaps your generation, the so-called baby boomers and so forth, I don't think we've done such a good job.
No, and I'm surprised that younger people. I don't know. I occasionally this spring I taught at Yale. And I'm always amazed that undergraduates aren't more angry at baby boomers. And I mean, yeah. If anything, I sense in them almost the opposite, a kind of sense of, you know, and maybe this is because these Yale students are just sort of very high achievers and self-flagellating, you know, people who just push themselves so hard all their lives. But I almost see them thinking like, oh, no, how can I repeat that kind of success? How can I, you know, I mean, not at the expense of the environment or social justice or anything like that, but they seem very eager, you know, to do well. They haven't descended into some kind of nihilism or rejection. But this, I don't know, we may be looking at very unusual subsets of a generation too.
It may be, right? Yeah, that I don't know. Another thing that just impressed me is, despite the pandemic has been really hard for young people. Mm. I mean, it's been so isolating, right? I mean, imagine if we go to college and missing a year and a half of your college time, having to either stay home or abide by the rules of the pandemic and so forth. But another thing that really did impress me teaching these last couple of years, first of all, how international, you know, through the internet, obviously, through Wi-Fi and all that, the young people are really internationally connected, right? So even in my classes, I had kids, like, they couldn't come to campus, so they were, like, checking into their Zoom classes from China. We had this, we had Muslim kids in the class, people from all over. Mm-hmm. And I think that at some level, young people, you know, are not so confined by this idea of like America first, nation first, we're only in our nation, that defines, as we've seen, you know, older generations. And I think that it's the nature of the way they communicate with each other and the way they conceive the world as more interconnected and facing problems that threaten not just the US, but the whole world, which the pandemic has certainly made us even more aware of how things threaten the whole world, right? Mm-hmm. I think bodes well, but we'll see, right?
We will see. All right, we have to take one quick break here. We're going to come back. This is going very fast, which is a good sign if things seem like they're going fast, but with Francisco Goldman.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked.
All right. As usual, I have to thank and want to thank Kat Pastor, the technical producer of the show. She's here in the building in the studio with me, although she is, you know, we are separated by glass. One of us is in a diorama. We haven't really decided which one. Also, of course, Betsy Kaplan, producer of this episode. Francisco Goldman is most recently the author of Monkey Boy. He is a writer and journalist, and he has published 5 novels, including this one. So, and 2 books of nonfiction, etc. All right, so... You know, there's so many things. This has gone by kind of fast. And there's so many things, at least for me it has, so many things that I wanted to talk about. And I'd love to be ending on a high note, but it might not work out that way. Maybe we'll get to the high note. So Betsy Kaplan and I have been talking for weeks and weeks and maybe months and months now about grief. And it made me realize that prior to this, I don't think I had experienced grief. I had experienced deep sorrow. I took care of each of my parents as they were declining and dying, you know, and I was very sad about that. But boy, there's this other thing, like grief. It's like this dark serpent that's inside you that doesn't even seem like it belongs in this world. And it just kind of rears up and just bites you from the inside. And I started to feel like there's, if you haven't experienced that, It's one of the reasons I kind of like and trust Biden, because I know he's been through that. And that's something you deal with a lot, too, was this whole of like, what is this grief thing? And then what do you do after it?
Yeah, I was not prepared for it, right? It was, I thought I'd known loss. I thought I'd known sad things. I'd say, I was not prepared for what happened, you know, it's otherworldly, like you said, you know, 1 minute, especially sudden grief, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many kinds of grief and they can devastate us in different ways. I think the loss of a child is something that, I don't see how anyone really ever gets over it, but going from 1 second to being a husband whose life is sort of defined by his marriage and his hopes for creating a family in the future and everything else, and then in one split second, suddenly you're a widower, right? With this shattered life, who in their heart and soul still feels like a husband. I had no idea. I had never suspected that I had those kinds of tears inside me. I had never sobbed like that in my life. I had never, and people know that, traumatic grief actually affects the brain. We hear about hallucinations and things like that. And those are caused because the trauma of grief essentially, puts lesions in brain synapses that usually kind of keep our subconscious, our unconscious, and our conscious minds apart. And what happens during traumatic grief is like the unconscious kind of starts leaking into the day, which is why it can be so trippy and you have those really weird hallucinations like I was having during that grief period. One thing that to me, say her name, that those first 3 years after Ada's death and even the first five were just so completely intense. And of course, I would never say I miss the intensity of those days, but I know I will never know anything so intense again and so focused again. I kind of withdrew and worked on my book, and I refused to sell the book. I didn't want to take money for the book. And I lived with, and I just knew, what did I want to do with that book, Say Her Name? I wanted to, one, not let, it was the opposite of the usual grief prescription. I didn't want to let Ada go. I wanted to keep her with me. And the way I kept her with me was making up scenes between us, like as though she was still there, So I wanted to do a portrait of her where it would seem so intimate. You would feel like she's there breathing and speaking on the page. No, and it was kind of like sacrificing myself to be able to do that, because it was like the opposite of letting go.
Yeah. Right?
So it was that, but I also wanted to give a record about what I was living through, because the book goes back and forth between recreating her life and our love and talking about grief. And so often some days, I would have like a weird hallucination and it would go right into the book. So I think the book is a palpable record or depiction of what traumatic grief can be like. And one thing I learned, through the years, because there's other books, some of the famous grief books, they kind of try to present ideas of how you should live through grief. And that's fine. That's going to help you. That's a good thing. But this book doesn't do that. My book, I wanted to show you how it can be. Right. And I think that can be helpful for people too, because, not everyone acts like a hero in grief. Not everybody is like as cool and collected as, some writers about grief have been. Some of us just totally fall to pieces, and that's okay. Right. It's really important to understand that everybody's grief is different, and everybody's grief is going to last for a different amount of time. And because one person grieves for a shorter period of time, it doesn't mean their grief was less meaningful, right? It's just different for everybody. And that's the main thing. If you know someone who's grieving, or you yourself suddenly find yourself in grief, just remember that the best way through grief is to listen to it and allow it to take its course and don't try to hide from it. I think the worst thing you can do is to try to repress it and run away from it, right? The best way out of grief is by going through it.
That's a really good way to put that. Yeah, the best way out of grief is to go through it. People keep mentioning to me this book called The Body Keeps Score. I keep thinking, I don't need to read that book. First of all, the title tells me everything I need to know. You know, yes, I understand. Yeah. I mean, to your point, the brain is keeping score, but I'm sure there's these tensions and all these kinds of things. Just very quickly, we only have like a couple minutes left here. We should say that it looks as though Say Her Name will become a movie, and I mean, I don't know, you'll in a way have to go through this all over again go ahead.
I have distance from it. You know, I got through it, right? Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. Like, I got through it. It was hard and I got through it. So I'm fine dealing with it now. And yeah, it was crazy. I had this fellowship at Harvard in 2018, 2019. In the spring of 2019, I was sitting in my office. I get a phone call. It's Benicio del Toro, the actor. And I knew that there was a script that they were trying to make it a movie. They'd show me the script that, you know, to be honest, I hadn't been so crazy about it, but you know, and he said, I really want to do this movie, but I don't want to do this script. I want a script that's like the book. And I remember we talked on the phone for like 2.5 hours. He's amazing. Mm. I mean, that guy, he'll like take one sentence out of the book and imagine a whole movie scene out of it. Mm. And we've been working, he and I, we worked close on the script for, you know, ever since. Yeah. Off and on, right? That other stuff. And yeah, well, now they're up there. They got an actor. They have the whole package. And now they're out there in that stage of, you know, getting the money. So, I mean, it is Benicio del Toro. He's Latin America's greatest male star. So that gives me hope,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And every girl in Mexico seems in love with him in some way. Right, you mentioned Benicio del Toro and they swoon. So Benicio del Toro as me, Frankie G, is pretty funny. My wife.
No, I can sort of, when this was first mentioned, I thought, I don't really know you or anything like that, but I can sort of see this. I think actually, you know, even listening to you talk and stuff like that, I could see him getting you.
We get along really well. Don't forget, he's Puerto Rican, yeah. Right? But he really grew up in Philly.
Right. So, yeah,
it's like Philly guys, Boston guys, and it's so different.
No, some people would say that's an unbridgeable chasm, Philadelphia and Boston.
Well, that's what makes them alike, right? Yeah. That's what makes them similar. Right.
So we have to stop, unfortunately. I could happily talk to you for another hour, but they don't give me that.
It's been great, Colin. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did too. Thanks so much. And the book is wonderful. It's Monkey Boy by Francisco Goldman. It is a novel. It is very much based on events of his life, but on things in his mind too. And it's how the whole world can be contained in a very brief time. Particularly if you're sort of traveling, moving around, things are coming back.